Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. WBAI, where this show usually originates, is still fundraising, so this all-new show has been prepared exclusively for the KPFA and podcast audience. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Bruce Bartlett, a former Reagan advisor who thinks that the time for supply-side economics is past and it's time for a return to Keynes. This is a position that's caused him to lose some friends on the right. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Lauren Weber, who thinks we should all tighten our belts and learn to love cheapness, which is a kind of anti-Keynesian message, although that wasn't my intention. Of course, the recession has been tightening our belts for us involuntarily, but Lauren Weber is all for a consensual embrace of parsimony. Before all that, some words in the economic news. On Thursday, we learned that the U.S. economy grew at a stronger-than-expected 3.5% rate between the second and third quarters. That's an annualized real rate, meaning that it's adjusted for inflation and then essentially multiplied by 4 to extend the quarter's results to a full year. Well, this is probably enough to mark the official end of the 2008-2009 recession, the longest and deepest since the 1930s. It doesn't mean that our troubles are over. Most of the growth came with a federal subsidy, and the pattern of growth wasn't all that encouraging. And the rate itself, 3.5%, is fairly middling by historical standards. Consumer spending rose smartly in the quarter, led by a 22% real rise in durable goods spending. But this increase was mostly the result of car purchases subsidized by the Federal Cash for Clunkers program. Other forms of federal spending also boosted the growth rate, with about two-thirds of that coming from the Pentagon. Inventories were up, which can be a positive when the economy is expanding. But if this burst of growth doesn't pan out, the inventories are going to sit on the shelves and gather dust, and working them off will be a drag in future months. Other sectors made less impressive contributions. State and local government spending was barely positive and was actually down after adjusting for inflation. Fiscal troubles at the sub-Washington level are serious. Exports were up, but imports were up more strongly, suggesting that the U.S. economy is still importing too much for its long-term health. When you consistently import more than you export, you're living beyond your means and borrowing the difference. That's part of what got us into trouble, and it looks like we haven't shed those evil ways yet. We did see the first quarter-to-quarter rise in residential investment, meaning the construction of new housing and the renovation of existing stock, a first rise in 4 years, though nearly three-quarters of house purchases recently have come with a federal subsidy of some sort. Business investment in equipment and software, one of the principal motors of economic growth, rose at a weak 1% annual rate, adjusted for inflation, last quarter. Investment in non-residential structures, things like warehouses, shopping malls, and office buildings, was off 9% in real terms for the quarter. Troubles in commercial real estate are hurting the banks and is likely to be a drag on any recovery in the coming months. Already we're seeing some fallback in the September figures. New house sales fell over 3% last month, and the initial estimate for August was revised down by a similar amount. Personal income was flat in September, with wage income down, and spending fell by a half a percentage point as car sales plunged after the expiration of the Cash for Clunkers program. With income flat and spending down, the savings rate rose, but at 3% it's still very low, and only a bit above half what it was in May. If the savings rate is going to get back to its long-term historical average around 8% of after-tax income, then we're going to have to see month after month of restrained spending numbers, especially if job and income growth are going to be weak, as I and most others expect. More on all this when we hear from Lauren Weber in about half an hour. And we're even seeing the government subsidy effect in the income figures. Transfer receipts, that is, unemployment benefits, Social Security checks, and the like, are about the only component of personal income that's showing decent growth. And there's little sign that this spurt of growth has helped out the job market. Applications for unemployment insurance fell by 1,000 last week, but the level is about where we were in July. The improving trend we saw in spring and early summer has slowed considerably in recent weeks. Next week, we'll get the employment report for October. It's too early to do any projections, except to say that I'm not expecting many positive numbers. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Bruce Bartlett. That was Some of Supply and Demand by The Hives from back in 2000, Detroitish garage punk via Sweden. My first guest is Bruce Bartlett, author of The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics, and A New Way Forward, just out from Palgrave Macmillan. Bartlett is an economic historian who worked as an advisor to Jack Kemp back in the 1970s when they were devising supply-side economics, the doctrine that cutting taxes, especially on the rich, would unleash a wave of entrepreneurship that would enrich us all. It didn't work out quite that way, though Bartlett thinks it did in its time. But he also thinks that that time is now past, and now argues for the necessity of government spending to get us out of this slump and over the longer term for a value-added tax, or a VAT. A VAT is often described as a national sales tax, which isn't exactly right. It's a tax imposed on the value added at all stages of production. For example, the retailer of a washing machine has to buy it from the manufacturer. The difference between the wholesale purchase and retail selling price is the retailer's value added, and that's the amount that the value-added tax would be applied to, usually a percentage of, say, 10 to 15%. The maker of the washing machine also had to buy steel, rubber, and other raw materials. The difference between the manufacturer's selling price and the cost of those materials is its value-added. The steel maker had to buy ore and other raw materials, and so on down the chain. The cost of a VAT is buried in the purchase price, though a VAT is often seen as regressive, meaning that it hits the poor more than the rich, because the poor consume a larger share of their income than the rich. It doesn't have to be that way. Essentials like food can be exempted from a VAT. There can be rebates through the income tax system for people with lower incomes. And since a VAT can raise a lot of money, any inequities on the tax side can be remedied on the spending side with social spending. That's the way it works in the social democratic states of Western Europe. I'm not sure that things would work out that way here. The pain of a VAT, which is politically radioactive, is not likely to be offset in the U.S. by any Swedish-style benefit packages. But this is all worth talking and thinking about. Apologies for some inept button pushing on my part. I cut off the beginning of Bartlett's answer to my question about the background to supply-side economics. He started by talking about the dominance of Keynesianism in economics and politics in the 1970s. Just a few seconds are missing, nothing significant. Okay, Bruce Bartlett. You were present at the creation of supply-side economics, but you think it's outlived its usefulness. So let's start by going back to the evolution of supply-side economics. How did it come to be, and what did you witness?
And its main idea was increasing government spending, and deficits were important for growth. And the Keynesians also had this idea of something called the Phillips curve, which said that the way to cure unemployment was to raise inflation, and the way to cure inflation was to raise unemployment. And this led to a kind of a ratchet effect where inflation just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And the supply-siders came along and said that this was clearly not working. We needed a new idea. And the supply-side idea was to have tight money and tax cuts, because the tight money would eliminate the inflation, and the tax cuts would increase growth. And this policy was implemented by Ronald Reagan, and it did bring down inflation very rapidly and restored economic growth to the economy in the 1980s. The problem is that just as Keynesian economics became misapplied in inappropriate circumstances, I think the Reagan idea was misapplied during the 2000s by George W. Bush, and this led, at least in part, to the crisis that we're now in. And I think we need different policies to get us out.
Some people on the left would argue that supply-side economics was just a theoretical cover for a gift to rich people. They just wanted to cut taxes on the rich and came up with a reason for it. What do you say to that?
Well, that's just not true. I know people say that, but I was on Jack Kemp's staff in 1977, and I know what he was thinking. I know what I was thinking when we drafted the Kemp-Roth tax bill, which formed the basis of the Reagan tax cut in 1981. And I assure you, our only belief, our only hope was that this would restore economic growth and prosperity to everyone.
The deficit famously exploded during the Reagan years. Was that what you expected, and why did it happen?
Well, it didn't really explode. It just it didn't get better, and the main reason is simply that not enough was done to control spending. And of course, Reagan did increase spending dramatically on for national defense, but I think that was money well spent that led to the collapse of the Soviet Empire. But I think by and large, Reagan's policies worked. And I will defend what we did back in those days.
Now, a corollary of supply-side economics is often said to be that it was a scheme to, as Grover Norquist is, the phrase is usually associated with Grover Norquist, but you investigate its actual origin, but the starving the beast, that is, by restricting revenues, it would lead inevitably, maybe with a delay, but inevitably to contracting spending. It didn't really work out that way. What happened?
Actually, I think Grover said is he wanted government small enough to drown it in a bathtub or something like that. But the original idea of starving the beast was this, that the Republicans had been long associated with the idea of a balanced budget. That was what they thought was really important economically. But the problem was that as spending increased, Republicans ended up supporting higher taxes to reduce the deficit. And when the deficit came down, then the spending would just go back up again. So you had kind of a ratchet effect where taxes were getting higher and higher, but spending never came down. And so the idea that the supply-siders had was just cut taxes and force the pressure to reduce deficits to be channeled into reducing spending. The problem with that, and I think that was a plausible idea in the 1970s, but what happened was that once people decided that the tax that the deficit didn't matter, as Dick Cheney once said, you ended up increasing spending and cutting taxes at the same time, and now there's no pressure to reduce the deficit from anybody, and so they've gotten us to the point where I think we have to think very seriously going forward about a really significant deficit reduction that will have to include higher revenues.
Do you agree that the deficit doesn't matter?
No, I do not believe it. I mean, it depends. I mean, if you tell me today, is today's deficit hurting the economy? I say no. I think it's helping the economy. And the evidence is that interest rates are very, very low. The money the Treasury is borrowing is money that would, figuratively speaking, be just in a mattress gathering dust. So insofar as that money is being mobilized, that's good for the economy. But over time, deficits are negative saving. And if we want more saving and more investment to finance growth in the future, deficits have to be brought down. And so my worry is not today's deficits, but those 2 or 3 years and further down the line.
Now let's step back a bit in history. Although there are several schools of economics on the right end of the political spectrum, which often dispute each other vigorously, they were fairly united over the years in hostility to John Maynard Keynes. You have come around to revere Keynes. Tell us why and how that came to be.
Well, I think Keynes is completely misunderstood by conservatives. I think, although he never called himself a conservative, I think, in fact, he was. His main concern in the 1930s was that if the economy didn't turn around, if unemployment didn't come down, that the entire capitalist system was going to be overthrown for some form of socialism. And I think his view was that if we can intervene in the economy, in the macro economy, we can continue to allow capitalism to more or less operate at the micro level. And so I think that was correct. And I think that the current circumstances that we have today are more like those in the 1930s than any other historical experience we have. And so I think that the time for Keynesian economics has you know, come full circle and come back around again. And I admit that.
And one reason that Keynes is appropriate today is because he devised his most famous ideas in a time of deflation. Supply-side economics came to be during a time of inflation, so there's this issue of historical appropriateness, right?
Very critical distinction, right. Yes.
What is the risk of deflation now? What's causing that?
Well, the main problem is we had this bubble in the housing market. And we know from analysis that people tend to spend about 5 to 10 cents out of each additional increase in their wealth. So if the stock of housing, the value rises by, say, $1 trillion, people are going to spend $100 billion of that more each year. But the reverse also holds, that when wealth declines, spending falls along with it. And the problem the technical problem we had is that velocity fell, which is the rate of turnover of money in the economy. If people were still spending at the same rate that they were spending a year ago, the GDP would be about $1.5 trillion higher. So the trick is to how to get people to spend again, and that brings us back to Keynesian economics.
You also argue that Keynes has an unfair rap as an inflationist, and he was actually concerned about inflation when that was historically appropriate. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think Keynes was very strongly opposed to inflation when that was the problem. But when the problem is falling prices, it's quite obvious that you need inflationary policies to counteract the deflation. And Keynes was right about that then, and he would be right if he were saying it today. The problem is that his policies were misapplied during periods of time when prices were stable or even rising, thus causing inflation to become a problem. And certainly inflation will become a problem in the future if we don't change our policies when appropriate. But right at this moment in time, inflation is what the economy desperately needs.
I was speaking with Bruce Bartlett, author of The New American Economy, just out from Palgrave Macmillan. There are some economists of the Austrian persuasion who would argue that we do need a deflation, that it is purgative and curative, and trying to engineer an inflation only postpones the need for that adjustment. What do you say to that?
Well, I think if we were talking about a run-of-the-mill, a recession, that would be one thing. But, I mean, this is the second worst crisis in American history, and I think the Austrian idea that we should just stand by and do nothing is insane, and I think that people who believe that are basically idiots.
Okay, that's a refreshing burst. So how do you engineer a reflation? You make a distinction between reflation and inflation. I assume that what we really need to avoid a deflation is a reflation, right? How do you engineer one?
The problem is Fed policy. I mean, monetary policy is ultimately what will reverse the deflation. The problem you run into in situations like we're in right now is you have something that economists call a liquidity trap, where if interest rates are too low, then the Fed is not able to increase liquidity by buying bonds with newly created money. And what you're seeing is that banks have vast amounts of reserves that they're simply not lending. And the trick is to how to get that money mobilized and moving. The problem is, as economists put it, is monetary policy is pushing on a string. So it brings us back to the problem of how do you get people to spend? How do you get turnover, the money to turn over more rapidly? And what Keynes said is when private spending falls, it has to be replaced by public spending. And that's what Obama has tried to do with the stimulus plan in February. The problem is that I think it was grossly oversold. They predicted too much from too little. That too much of the package was just simply transfers that did not increase spending, and we're only just now starting to see some of the public works projects really get going, which will help spending. So, and also I think going forward, we're going to have a serious problem with unemployment long past the point at which everybody recognizes that the recession is over.
Is there anything we can do about that?
We're going to have to come up with some targeted policies, and unfortunately I don't know. I mean, there isn't a magic bullet. It's not like we can just do one thing and that'll take care of it. I think we're going to have to give a great deal of serious thought to the whole question of targeted policies to reduce unemployment, and that may involve retraining efforts, and maybe we need to encourage people to start their own businesses, and I don't know what, but I think that's going to be the big problem that everybody's going to be talking about for the next 2 or 3 years.
Now, a lot of people within the Fed and around the financial markets are talking about the need for the authorities to look for an exit strategy, to remove a lot of this stimulus to avoid igniting an inflation. Is this going to be a risk of repeating 1937's tightening, which just threw us back into depression?
Well, certainly we will have, I mean, there's no question that we'll have to unwind both the fiscal and the monetary stimulus at some point. But I think the danger of us doing it too soon is a lot less than the danger of us doing it too late, given the trauma of recent events. I think it's more likely that the Fed will wait too long to tighten, and that fiscal policy will remain stimulative for too long, well past the point that we should have tightened, so that down the road several years, it's almost certain that we're going to have inflation, and that will bring forth a completely different set of problems.
In the book, you argue that we need to increase taxes substantially, and you argue for a value-added tax. This is anathema on most Republican circles, but even beyond that. What are the virtues of a VAT in your estimation?
Well, the problem I see going forward is the problem of entitlements. Medicare in particular is just completely out of control. It's been growing 2% a year faster than the economy for years, and there's no policies in place, certainly nothing that Obama has proposed that is going to change that spending trajectory significantly. So my feeling is that going forward, we're going to have to figure out how to pay for it. And the idea, the right-wing fantasy idea that we're going to slash trillions of dollars out of Medicare and Social Security is just nuts. If only for political reasons, the political power of the elderly is already almost overwhelming, and it's going to get bigger as the size of the elderly population increases as the baby boomers get into their 60s. So I'm saying we're going to have to bite the bullet and raise taxes. And in any event, Democrats are not going to negotiate any kind of budget or deficit reduction deal with the Republicans if the Republicans are refusing to even talk about raising taxes. So higher taxes is a precondition for anything else we might do to reduce structural deficits. And history and experience in Europe and elsewhere shows that a value-added tax is a very effective way of raising revenue at relatively low economic cost. And I think that we absolutely have to do that because all the alternatives are worse.
You quote Larry Summers as having said about 20 years ago that the right hates a value-added tax because it's a money machine for government, and the left hates it because it's a tax on the poor. He said, we'll have a VAT when the right realizes that it is a tax on the poor, and the left realizes that it is a money machine. Was Summers right about that?
Yes, he's not right yet because both sides are still quite adamant about not having a VAT. But I think mostly what the fear, it's just fear of being attacked. Nobody wants to be the first one to say that we should do this. And I mean, just the other day I was on CNBC with my friend Larry Kudlow, and he said he was attacking me for wanting to Europeanize the American economy. And among conservatives, if you say, oh, you're going to take us down the road of Europe, that's enough to end the debate, you say. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think Europe's such a terrible place.
People are starving in the streets, aren't they?
Yes, you'd think so.
But what about the equity problem? It does. It can be a very regressive tax. It would hit the poor much harder than the rich. Is that a fair way to go about things?
I think that effect is overstated because you get those that effect by looking at 1 year's taxes out of 1 year's income. But if you look at taxes as a share of income over a lifetime, value-added taxes tend to be much more proportional to income. Now, that may still not make them very good from your point of view, but it's not quite as bad as it seems. Secondly, I don't think there's any question that if we do a VAT, we'll do other things at the same time that would in some way relieve the burden on the poor. But the key thing, and you can raise enough money from the VAT to do a lot of creative things on the spending side if you want to. So I think the key thing is to try to is admit the necessity and then try to work out the details.
I could hear a lot of populists, both left and right, saying that this is almost some sort of IMF-style austerity program for the United States. Is that what you envision?
Not necessarily, but on the other hand, I don't necessarily disagree with it either. I do think that we're going to have to go through a very gut-wrenching readjustment in the future because we simply cannot maintain the course that we're on. Something has to give. And whatever gives, I think, is worse than what I'm proposing. We're either looking at deficits so large and projected out to where they're permanent that it will lead to a financial collapse where you have massive inflation, massively high interest rates, and a collapsing dollar, or we're going to have to raise taxes in ways that are even more damaging to economic incentives than the VAT. So I don't really see any easy way out. Everybody's going to have to contribute to the solution to this problem.
What kind of tax rate do you envision, and what kinds of revenue are you looking to raise?
Well, it's very hard to say. I mean, current projections from the CBO show spending rising to about 30% of GDP from about 20-some percent over the next generation. So we're going to have to, obviously we cannot only fill that gap with taxes. We're going to have to cut spending as well, especially for Medicare. But I would envision that we would need to raise federal revenues as a share of GDP, maybe up into the 25% range long term. And if we're going to raise revenues by 6 or 7% of GDP over above what we'd get from the income tax once we're back to normal, I think it's clearly a flat rate consumption tax like a VAT makes a lot of sense. And we could get, I think the tax base for a VAT would be reasonably estimated at about a third of GDP. So under current conditions, we'd get roughly $50 billion a year of new revenue per percentage point. And the average VAT rate in Europe is about 20%. So I think we could bear that if we wanted to, or we could do less. But the main thing is to get the mechanism in place.
Finally, you started a few years ago as something of a heretic on the right by criticizing George W. as an imposter conservative. And I imagine this book is going to get you deeper into hot water. How have your friends from the Republican Party and the political right greeted your recent thinking?
Well, I lost an awful lot of friends, because, not to mention my job, because of that imposter book. And there are a great many people that I don't talk to anymore and don't talk to me. And a number of... Well, I won't go into detail about that, but I think that those who've remained friends with me, they're disappointed at my heresy, but they're not surprised by it.
Well, now you have an audience of Pacifica Radio. That was Bruce Bartlett, author of The New American Economy, just out from Palgrave Macmillan. Bartlett is pretty right-wing. I didn't think there was much point in challenging him on basic principles. Obviously, I don't share his admiration for Ronald Reagan. And while I think he's right that we can't continue on the course we're on, Medicare is not the problem. It's part of a broader problem with our healthcare finance system, rampant waste caused by private insurance company-dominated system that can only be cured with a single-payer transformation. But no need to repeat the many segments I've done on that right now. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, the program behind the news. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to praise cheapness. Hardly an episode of Behind the News these days without a piece of a Beethoven piano sonata. That was a bit of the third movement of the Sonata No. 31, performed by Andras Schiff. My next guest is Lauren Weber. Weber, a former reporter with Newsday, the Long Island newspaper, is the author of In Cheap We Trust, the story of a misunderstood American virtue, just out from Little Brown. In what follows, we discuss John Maynard Keynes and the paradox of thrift. The idea that while thrift might make sense for individuals, if too many people hold back on their spending, it can cause recession or worse. In other words, a private virtue can be a public vice. In his most famous work, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, Keynes praised a poem called The Fable of the Bees by Bernard Mandeville, first published in the early 18th century. In it, Mandeville argued that spending was good and saving could be bad. Keynes, who once proudly declared himself an immoralist, took clear pleasure in reporting that the book was once convicted by a jury of being a public nuisance, and he embraced the scandal of it all. Spend, 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 Keynes would argue. Lauren Weber disagrees. Welcome, Lauren. First of all, before we go into the American history of cheapness, what about your own personal history with cheapness? You've got some intimate experience with it, right?
I do. I was raised by a father who was compulsively cheap. He once tried to ration the toilet paper at our family's house. Unfortunately, he couldn't find a way to monitor that, so it didn't last very long, or I should say fortunately. He also kept the heat at about 50 degrees when we were growing up in New England, and you know, I can remember doing my homework with my hats and scarves on. So I grew up with a father like this, and I complained bitterly about it. And then when I got older, and especially once I started supporting myself, I sort of turned into him and realized that he was actually onto something all along. He had passed down some very important and valuable lessons about living within my means and not going into debt and living simply.
Now, I grew up with something like that, not quite as extreme, but something like that. And my reaction was to become irresponsible and profligate, probably not to my own benefit. That kind of rebellion never occurred to you?
My brother is very different from my sister and I. My sister and I sort of took on a lot of my father's characteristics, and my brother went more the direction of my mother, who is sort of reasonable in how she spends money. My brother is a bit more of a hedonist himself. I think it's always some combination of the early experiences and your own personal psychology.
Now, as a country, the United States has a contradictory history of excess and cheapness, sometimes in the same people, sometimes at the same time. But I guess the ur figure for a lot of this is Benjamin Franklin. Tell us how he figures into the history of parsimony.
Well, you can't write a book about thrift without talking about Ben Franklin because he's kind of our poster child. He's our national poster child for thrift. You know, he's the one who popularized the saying, a penny saved is a penny earned, and there are countless savings banks named after him in this country. But he himself was a much more interesting character than that. He did promote the idea of frugality and hard work. His two main virtues were industriousness and frugality. But to him, it was not about, it was not a religious, it was not frugality in a religious sense. It was really part of his political economy. He and many of the other founders believed that for the United States to develop its own robust domestic economy, individuals had to work hard and save their money so that they could then invest in a new field or in a new factory or hire a new apprentice. It was really, frugality was a means to raising capital so that you could then help grow the domestic economy. This was a time when they were trying to detach the economy from Europe and mainly with England. So, you know, there's that part of it. I like the way he incorporated it into a whole political economy. But in his own life, Franklin was famously frugal in his early years, but then when he became older and he became fairly wealthy, and he retired at the age of 42, devoted himself to public service, and actually was known after that for being quite profligate. He would send home crates of fine linens and silks from France and England when he was stationed there on diplomatic missions.
I want to come back to that point in a second, but of course, before Franklin, there were the Puritans who kind of set the tone for a certain New England frugality. Were they as frugal as their reputation suggests?
No. One of the best things about writing this book was realizing how so many of the myths we've inherited were either totally incorrect or at least much more complex than we usually know. Now, the Puritans, you know, and their ideology, their religion told them, you defer your rewards until the afterlife. Your glory comes after death, but this life is meant for suffering and hard work. And but that didn't necessarily square with the Puritans who came to America, where they found an incredibly abundant land, where, you know, there was just so much land to be had and so many fish. They talked about 6-foot lobsters washing up on shore. And so it was a paradox for them. How do you handle this abundance, but also the religious rules to deny yourself constantly? So many Puritans, early Puritans, they got in trouble by ministers for wearing too many ruffles on their shirts, for wearing gold buttons instead of silver ones, to the point where some of the legislators, who were also religious leaders, had to pass sumptuary laws to try to get people to wear cotton breeches rather than silk breeches.
This suggests that some of our love of thrift, our cultural love of thrift, is aspirational and not something we actually intend to live by.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's more of a virtue we admire more than we aspire to. On the one hand, we can admire people like Benjamin Franklin or you know, some of those early Puritans or Quakers. But when it comes down to it, thrift is often a virtue Americans can't wait to relinquish. You know, and as soon as their incomes go up or they have access to more credit, generally they take advantage of that.
Let's take a little quick tour through the 19th century. There were saving societies and such, or almost philanthropic, that were founded in the 19th century to encourage saving among a working class that really didn't have too many pennies to spare. Give us the history of that kind of uplift movement.
Most of the early banks in America were started by wealthy individuals, often fairly conservative individuals. They considered this a philanthropic effort. So they would start the banks with their own capital, and mainly they saw it as a way to cure urban poverty. This was a time when there were a lot of paupers on the streets of cities, and cities were spending a lot of money on pauper relief, poor relief. And so these wealthy individuals said that if they could just get working class people to save some money and earn a little bit of interest, not only would it give them some financial security, but in the way of most early 19th century pronouncements at the time, the idea it was also make them much more moral people. It was a very well-intentioned effort. On the other hand, it completely ignored the fact that there were all kinds of structural reasons why Americans were poor. I mean, this was a totally unregulated economy. There was no very little social safety net, and most workers were kind of bounced around on this boom and bust cycle of the economy.
You said something about Franklin's own taste for excess, but there does seem to be a history of at least the upper classes prescribing austerity and parsimony for the poor and the middle income people, and while indulging themselves very generously. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. You know, you see that with throughout history, and probably even today you could find examples as well. But one of my favorites was a man named Simon William Strauss, who started the American Society for Thrift. And this was in 1914. And again, it was meant to get working people to start saving more. He happened to be a banker, so he also benefited every time somebody opened a savings account in one of his banks. But he later was arrested when he came to the U.S. with something like $1 million in jewels that he failed to claim to customs. So, you know, it suggests that he wasn't living quite as austerely as he was suggesting everybody else should.
I'm speaking with Lauren Weber, who's the author of In Cheap We Trust, just out from Little Brown. The Depression gave thrift a bad name, not only privately, I mean, not only popularly, but in the economics profession. Tell us about the paradox of thrift and the intellectual history of that.
Well, you know, yeah, the Depression was, forced many, many people to cut back. And when you have an unemployment rate of about 25%, there's a lot of people hurting, and they have no choice but to stop spending. Around this time, John Maynard Keynes, the British economist, developed what he called the paradox of thrift, which was the idea that thrift was a private virtue but a public vice, and that if people didn't continue to spend money, there would be no engine for economic growth. And this became very popular among most economists. And, you know, Keynes, we also credit him with being the thinker behind the New Deal. He said that government, in the absence of private stimulus, the government needs to prime the pump. So to him, it wasn't, I think for him, he could understand that individuals needed to cut back at those times, but he generally saw demand as being the driver of the economy. And this was an idea that in America just really took off. And Americans, I think, have internalized the paradox of thrift so much that we now think that spending money is a patriotic duty.
Your book comes out, and we're doing this interview in the midst of an economic crisis, which it was in no small part caused by excessive borrowing and excessive consumption. So do you think the pre-Keynesian ideas are going to come back into fashion?
To some extent. You know, I think we have to see that there is a limit to this idea that demand needs to drive the economy. Well, sustainable demand can drive the economy. What we had was an economy built on debt and borrowing, and that is not sustainable. So I think, you know, what it is partly, and even in economic circles, what I found is that there is a slow reconsideration of the paradox of thrift. I think, you know, we're getting to the point where we see that there needs to be a better balance. You can't just have consumer spending going gangbusters to the detriment of personal savings. You know, we've had the personal savings rate in this country has hovered near around 1% for much of the last decade. And I think we can see that's not enough. Individuals need to have a cushion. We need to have our own safety net, especially as government gets out of the business of providing safety nets. So I think maybe we'll get to the point where we can be a little bit more measured about that and maybe even be able to say, okay, a savings rate of maybe 5 to 10% allows room for, you know, financial security, but also enough spending to drive some growth, sustainable growth.
I do wonder how profligate Americans really are, because the middle and lower income brackets have had a pretty rough time of it, stagnant or declining real incomes for two or three decades. Are these tales of American excess overdone? How much reality is there to it?
Exactly, yeah, I think that's true. And in fact, the whole question of why are Americans saving so little is very complicated. I really don't think it comes down to the fact that, or the idea that Americans are buying too many flat-screen TVs and lattes. I think that's sort of a fiction that might have been created by people who are echoing conservative elites from hundreds of years ago who blame poverty on the poor. You know, I think that the problem here stems from much further back. You know, the costs of basics like housing and healthcare and education are going up much, much faster than wages. I mean, wages have been stagnating or even going down during some periods. You know, we also have a government that deregulated the financial services industry, which allowed banks to take on enormous amounts of risk and, you know, lend recklessly. We had two chairmen of the Federal Reserve, Bernanke and Greenspan, who basically ignored any indications that there was a bubble. So there were many, you know, I think ordinary individuals probably in some areas could have cut back and would have done well to cut back, but in the end, I think they were just taking their cues from politicians and economists who didn't want the party to end.
On the other hand, you used to be a retail reporter at Newsday, and you talk about how people shopped recreationally and at the same time said they were doing their patriotic duty by buying. How much truth is it to that? Were people really indulging in going to the mall as a form of entertainment?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that is true. You know, it's partly because most of the towns on Long Island where I was reporting don't even have downtowns anymore. I think for many people, shopping has become our national recreation, or browsing, or window shopping, or whatever it is. And, you know, even though I certainly don't lay the blame for the economic problems at the feet of, you know, individuals who are spendthrifts, that is one of the factors in what happened. And I think just as a culture, the message we get is really one of non-restraint or anti-restraint. And, you know, one thing that put it in perspective for me was that I read during my research that in the 1800s, most Americans had two sets of clothing. They had one set for Monday through Saturday, their work clothes, and then, you know, a nice dress or a suit for Sunday for church. I have probably 25 long-sleeve T-shirts in my closet. I don't spend a lot of money, and yet I have way too much stuff. And I think that, you know, it is kind of an epidemic here in America. It's partly why the off-site storage industry has exploded so much here.
And the houses keep getting bigger despite shrinking household size.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the one thing that upset me in my research also was finding that the average house built today is something like 38% larger than the average house built in 1975, and it actually has fewer occupants. You know, that's bad for the environment, too.
A lot of people would listen to an argument like yours and or any apostle of thrift and say, you know, that's just no fun. You're a wet blanket. You're a spoil sport. Where's the sensuality and the pleasure in life? Have we channeled all our pursuit of sensuality and pleasure into buying stuff?
Maybe not all of it, but a fair amount. But, you know, my response to that is, like, I consider myself to be not deprived of anything important. And, in fact, being thrifty is not about self-denial or abstinence. I mean, those things may happen, but, you know, that's really not the goal in itself. To me, being thrifty and frugal and cheap, the word that I actually embrace, is more about having freedom in my life and having autonomy. You know, because I live cheaply, I've been able to travel all over the world. I haven't been in debt. I was able to take 2 years off to write my book, which was a great privilege. To me, actually, the idea of spending, that sounds like imprisonment of a different kind, of being in debt. You know, to me, being frugal has bought me so much freedom in my life and so much pleasure.
So you're reclaiming the word cheap, huh?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. You know, it's one that people have a lot of negative associations with, which is partly why I wanted to use it for the book. It's a word that provokes very strong emotions, and I wanted to sort of get people interested in a dialogue about what cheapness or what frugality mean in America today.
Now, you must have conceived this project of the book at the end of the bubble, and now it came out in the midst of the bust. Has the society come around closer to your way of thinking?
Much more so. And at first, I was a little bit disappointed. I liked the idea that my message kind of cut against the grain of where the culture as a whole was going. But now, you know, when I tell people what the book is about, they, you know, they just nod their head, oh, yeah, that makes sense, you know, talking about spending less money, using fewer resources, living in a way that's easier on your wallet and on the environment. You know, it's something that people now, you know, are totally on board with. Not everybody, but many people just sort of nod their heads and say, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Of course, now there's an ecological dimension to this that wasn't there when Ben Franklin and the Puritans were riding high, is there?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there is a real synthesis between spending less money and using fewer resources. You know, the glib way to say it is cheap is the new green, but it's really true. To me, frugality is really the art of using things well. And I think in a disposable society and in a society where we Americans throw out something like 500 billion pounds of trash a year, we have to think more about how we're using our resources and what we're doing with our stuff in order to make it so that we're not on a planet that's just hurtling towards destruction. You know, I read that if every developing country became a consumer society in the way that we are, we would need something like 4 more planet Earths to support that consumption.
I guess we'll just get to work on finding some of those. Americans have had bouts with prudence in the past. I remember the early 90s, there was a recession and talk of Americans had reined in their use of credit and had changed their free spending ways, and then that all went down the drain a few years later. Is this just a temporary aberration, or do you think there's something more lasting going on?
Well, thrift has definitely been a cyclical virtue in America. And with the perspective of history, and it wasn't just, you know, the period after the 90s, it's, you know, you go back 300 years and you can see all the ways that we've ebbed and flowed in terms of our interest in living frugally. I do think this is more likely to be a trend than a permanent shift. The one thing that I think could change it is the environmental issues. You know, when people are forced to cut back, I think often what it does is create a lot of pent-up demand, and really in the end they can't wait to, you know, re-hook up the cable or get their gym membership going again or, you know, start eating out more often. I think in order to get people to rethink consumption on a more long-term basis, it has to come from some other reconsideration, and I think the environment for a lot of people provides that.
And do you think individual effort, individual commitment to frugality is enough, or there has to be something at a more political level?
Something at the more political level. You know, I think, well, you have to deal with the fact that wages have been stagnant and the costs of, you know, housing and healthcare and education have been going up so much. People cannot save money if they have no money to save. So I think, you know, there is a wider response to this in terms of reining in some of those costs. I mean, I would love to see a public option be available within the next few years in terms of healthcare. And then, you know, the other piece of it is the government has many ways to incentivize saving. Currently, many of them go to the upper class already, whether it's tax advantage, retirement accounts, things like that. We need to find better ways to encourage people down the income ladder to put money away and save.
And has doing this book and talking about it changed your attitude towards frugality, or are you more committed than ever?
I'm more committed than ever. I'm cheaper than ever. I started making my own laundry detergent while I was writing the book. You know, when you're thinking about these issues every day, you start to subject your own spending to a whole new level of scrutiny. So, you know, I'm not beyond indulging now and then. And in fact, I was in Morocco earlier this year, so I still like to travel and treat myself, but I'm definitely more careful than I ever was.
But one economic critique of this attitude is that that if you don't buy stuff, you have to devote a lot of time to it, and people are valuing their time too cheaply when they make their own laundry detergent.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that that's I've heard that argument many times. Well, for one thing, you know, how I value my time is my own choice, and I actually get a great deal of pleasure out of making things myself. I love to cook. You know, I think there are a lot of non-economic benefits to some of these things. There's a certain pride that you take in making your own things. I mean, I almost always make birthday cards myself and birthday presents. There's a lot of pride in that. It's more personal. You know what goes into the things that you're eating or making. So I really disagree with the idea that these are purely economic issues and questions.
And that was Lauren Weber, author of In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue, just out from Little Brown. Though not entirely sympathetic with her argument, it is an intelligent, interesting, and even charming book. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this bit from Handshakes by Metric. The Hives. Metric. I'm going soft. Till next week. Bye.
That's entertainment when the cameras roll.